Well, the initial impressions are that it's not particularly controversial from a left-wing perspective, not particularly engaged in any form of major advocacy or boundary pushing. The interesting thing from the Labour Party perspective, I suppose, is that compared to any other recent Labour leader that you could imagine doing this kind of speech, if indeed they would have been invited, which they probably wouldn't have been, would have been that he does make clear reference to a politics of redistribution, both at the beginning and again towards the end of the speech, as opposed to the contemporary left or social democratic interest in the politics of identity, or what we call the politics of recognition. Now, of course, he does talk about homophobia and sexism and racism, but they are bookended by this reference to inequality and the wealth of the world in which we live in, and the primary objective of redistributing that wealth for those resources.
You mentioned when we were watching it, you picked out the phrase "another world is possible," which has a specific historical, or relatively recent historical resonance.
I'm thinking of the social forums and the great period of optimism at the beginning of the century, with the European and global social fora in Italy, in Brazil, and wherever. And maybe it's a pointed thing to note that it's possible because Jeremy Corbyn himself has been on the left vanguard of the Labour Party in its period of new Labourism, that he might be using those phrases to try and remind people that there was a period maybe 15 years ago or so where indeed a lot more people seemed to think that another world was possible. Before this kind of collective amnesia, this kind of buying into the neoliberal ideas and fighting over potentially nice versions of neoliberalism over harsher versions of neoliberalism. So it may not be an accident that he's used that phrase.
Do you think it's an indication that his interpretation of his appeal is not necessarily lagging behind, but that he's referencing it in terms of, or he's understanding it in terms of that sort of framework of 2000 and the global resistance movement?
Well, I don't know. I don't know whether he wrote the speech. I don't know whether he had probably had people look at it at least. But it is possible that even if he didn't think about it, that people might have said to him, okay, it's a relatively young audience, so a lot of these people maybe don't remember it, probably don't remember the time before New Labour. That is 20 years, more than 20 years, that we've had a version of New Labour. But I think it's very... it would be very appropriate for somebody like Jeremy Corbyn, as leader of the party and somebody who did well in the recent election, to remind people that the ideas he's espousing are not necessarily novel ideas, and there's nothing wrong with that. That he's trying to make a connection. In other words, if it was an older audience, I think he might even more explicitly make the connection that he is a continuing, he's that golden thread, maybe with a more traditional Labour Party from the 1970s, 1980s.
Well, and before then, right? Because that comes immediately after he's quoting Shelley. And that's on the NME website. They've managed, just like The Guardian, to spell Shelley's name wrong. His middle name's pretty difficult, actually. Is his middle name Bitchy? Percy Bitchy Shelley with two E's. And so this another word is possible thing comes immediately after he's quoted Shelley. I mean, why do you think he's put that in there, the Shelley with two E's?
Well, I think he probably had a problem. He probably wanted to reference somebody. And it's probably a lowest common denominator. I don't know, maybe I'm doing him a disservice, but it's possibly a lowest common denominator. You know, who am I happy to reference that will connect, but is not, contagious? Or people won't be reading too much into. And maybe Shelley, A, is seen as partly kind of inoffensive, but also with these earlier, social ideas or socialist ideas about shaking off your chains and workers of the world, you've nothing to lose but your chains, so maybe there's a connection there.
Well, you can imagine how it irritated Nigel Farage. This is another story on the NME website. Farage was calling everybody in the crowd Marxist, or suggesting that Farage being a fascist.
Well, this is a trope that you get with critiques of the left, of the emergence of, even within the Labour Party, the re-emergence of Jeremy Corbyn. It's this idea that, don't these people know about Marxism? Don't they know what it really is? Are they all fools? Did they not read any history books?
That's exactly what Farage is getting at, isn't it?
And
so I was wondering if he'd quoted Marx on stage, that would have created quite a reaction, wouldn't it, from the
right. And I think if it was a different venue, I think you may well have quoted Marx on stage. But and I think that maybe that's the point that the Shelley quote may be playing. I'm not saying it's definitely playing, but it may be a connection with the, you know, the 18th, 19th, early 20th century ideas about the future of the world being the future of the worker. It could be, but the way it's possible we're reading too much into this. As I say, it's possible somebody looked at a draft of the speech and said, put a Shelley quote in there, and that'll connect well. Another point that links with that is that he does talk about creativity a lot,
yeah.
Which is something that, A, the Tories would never talk about, and probably...
Well, they talk about innovation, wouldn't they?
Innovation, yes, but they're talking about artistic creativity. Look what they do to artistic communities and the potential for artists and artistic communities and their survival. And obviously he's chiming in with the concert. I think he possibly hasn't been to a Glastonbury concert before.
Well, he was quite careful, wasn't he? Because he said he'd been to Glastonbury.
Yeah.
But I mean, he doesn't pretend that he's been to the festival before.
Yeah. I'm guessing he probably hasn't been. But I do think it's an important thing to know. Because in the heyday of the pre-New Labour era, so maybe...
You said pre, as in before, not pre-the Mexican.
Yeah. Pre-before. That obviously a lot of artists survived... because they could draw the dole, and it gave them a...
Well, we were talking about this the other night, right? I mean, Mark Fisher's argument is that you had a whole explosion of creativity throughout the 70s and the 80s, or the early 80s at least, because people had time, essentially, because they could sign on, or maybe they were at art school, and they had time, people like Jarvis Cocker and so on, and all those groups that came up in the early 80s.
Yeah.
And then punk as well, to some extent as well, came about because people had time, whereas now you don't, and therefore you've had a sort of embourgeoisement or whatever... of rock music and pop music, like people, there's figures about the groups and singers in the top 10 and their social backgrounds, and it's changed quite considerably because people don't have the time available.
But I think not only is the creativity issue, which was mentioned a couple of times in there, not just something that, because I mean, obviously the Tories aren't referenced in this speech, which I think is a positive thing, because it then takes it out of this, you know, political catcalling. But not only were the Tories not talking about creativity, but a lot of politicians wouldn't be talking about creativity. A lot of Labour politicians wouldn't be talking about creativity. And I think he is kind of chiming in with that more holistic idea of socialism, that socialism is not just about issues about the means of production. It's also about tackling alienation and exploitation and potential to live as a full human being and not to be totally preoccupied with earning a living and earning a wage and being in that system of trading labour. So there's a lot of kind of socialistic ideas, extra Labour Party above the kind of norm of debate that he's hinting at there, which I think are probably not accidental.
Yeah, he's drawing on history for that, isn't he? He mentioned E.P. Thompson at some point. I don't know what he says. You heard the message from E.P. Thompson earlier.
Yeah.
And I don't know what that message was. What he says, what a wonderful man he was. So yeah, he's drawing on this kind of, just like Sarah Margaret called it, hormonal socialism.
Yeah, and also in keeping with the history, I mean, he congratulates Michael Eaves at the beginning. He brings him on stage, and you know, visibly wants the crowd to congratulate and to thank Michael Eaves. So in a way, he's almost making a link with that hippie ideal of the origins of Glastonbury and connecting that with the socialist ideal, seeing that's seamless, as many socialists would, of course, see as seamless. It's not problematic in any way.
Yeah, because it's a jumble of different traditions, isn't it?
Yeah,
trying to unite it into one.
I mean, overall, I think we'd have to say that the speech isn't particularly dynamic. It's not saying anything radical. I think it is interesting that it is the kind of speech that, with the exceptions of the reference to Trump and the Grenfell Tower tragedy, it almost...
You call it a tragedy? That's very... Your critical discourse analysis. Are you happy? There was an article in The Guardian the other day questioning the... And I was writing something about it, and I was very careful. You know, I don't even know if it's okay to use it as the word disaster. The word tragedy is problematic in the context. I'm pulling you up on this.
It is problematic. But with the exception of those two references, this speech could have almost been written or given 10 years ago or 15 years ago.
Could it have been given by Ed Miliband, do you think?
I don't think so. I mean, not just practically in the sense that Ed Miliband, why would he have been invited to give such a speech? I mean, obviously, if the Labour Party had won the 2010 or the 2015 election, possibly Ed Miliband would have showed up 2 years ago. But since they didn't, I don't think Ed Miliband... I think Ed Miliband might have felt comfortable enough to go, I'm not sure.
Well, he did a radio show this week in which he was interviewing the guy out of Napalm Death. And, yeah. and Ed Miliband tried to read that. I forget what the term is, but this sort of like death metal groan or whatever it is. So he's become a bit of a cult figure now. He's had a bit of a revival. Ed Miliband seems a bit cuddly. Do you think Corbyn here is drawing on his age much? You know, playing a sort of elder statesman, because as soon as it started, the first word that you said was Mandela. Do you think he's consciously?
Well, obviously, there is always that, you know, cult of personality idea, whether projected by the individual or the party, and this idea that the lost flock are looking for somebody, that kind of spiritual messiah complex idea. So that, particularly at a pyramid stage in Glastonbury on a Saturday afternoon, if you say this is the messiah, a certain amount of people are going to show up and cheer and clap yeah. and... now, so obviously we can't deny the part of, like, there will be probably people who are cheering and shouting Jeremy Corbyn there who didn't even vote and have no qualms about the fact that they didn't even vote.
You think so?
I'm pretty sure there'll be obviously a certain percentage of people there who probably didn't vote.
I mean, a lot more young people voted than anybody.
And of course we know, just from the prices of tickets and, you know, any research in Glastonbury in the last 10 years, that it isn't a working class festival in the sense that,
well, that
it is quite difficult to actually go for the weekend for people who don't have a good job.
Well, it's more difficult to buy tickets, as in, like, to actually get your hands on tickets rather than... I don't know, I mean, it's having been only once in 2008, I found it just a priceless experience. The funny thing is, the right, in terms of things that I've seen on Twitter, that's been their main criticism. Ooh, you know, working class hero talking to people who paid 230. Everybody suddenly knows the price of a Glastonbury ticket, but everybody's paid to be there. You know, you're not even allowed to jump over the fence anymore. So you think, to some extent, that's a valid criticism?
Well, put it this way, every year, at least for the past number of years, there has been the left field tent. So there has been conversations. People have been invited. Billy Bragg has been very...
Well, Tony Benn's always been there, hasn't he? And of course, Tony Benn...
Yeah, Tony Benn was always there. No, but Tony Benn, as far as I know, was never on the main stage.
Yeah.
But then Tony Benn was never, nearly, but never the leader of the Labour Party.
It's quite difficult to imagine that in an early 80s context, isn't it?
Well,
to imagine.
These are the things that I think go into that speech. Now, as I said, whether it was a collaborative speech, obviously he's capable of writing that speech on his own, but in terms of a collaborative speech and being the elder statesman, to bring it back to your point, I do think he is conscious of the work of people like Tony Benn being, just every day, being leader of the Labour Party as he is now. Had he not to directly reference that, there's no need to directly reference the fact that there's been this tent on site for a number of years and people did come and make speeches. In a 15-minute speech or a 30-minute speech, there's no need to go into all, like, the thanking. It's not like the Oscar speech where he has to thank everybody. But I do think he's conscious of the elder statesman, and I do think he's conscious of trying to make a link with Labour before New Labour without explicitly mentioning it.
Did you, at the same time, did you notice any bits that could have been given by Tony Blair? There's a lot of let's in there, isn't there?
Yeah, the let's and...
Let's do things better and do things differently. Well, that's the blandest possible
thing. Yeah. But that might be a way of not countering the austerity mode of the Tories without explicitly mentioning austerity, which has the disadvantage of giving a lack of focus, but then it has the advantage, when you don't mention austerity, of making it more timeless and less... contemporaneous. But I think that Tony Blair was very keen on the not only but also. So this third, which was very central to the third way politics, that it we can take the best of the left and we can take the best of the right and we forge a new path, which was basically totally ridiculous, that you couldn't have. So, for example, you could have low taxation and great social services.
Mm.
Now, I don't think Tony Blair himself ever explicitly said that, but that was the kind of argument that was being said a lot, that we can take innovation and we can take flexibility, but we can be inclusive and we can be progressive. But when it actually came to a policy, because they were basically a neoliberal party, things ended up not being progressive and not being inclusive, and ended up increasing inequality. Tony Blair's speech would probably jump out of the detail of a Blair speech would probably jump out at you more, in that it would be less perennial and less timeless, and it'd be Tony Blair's speech would look very much of the now, as in the now being the end of the last millennium, the beginning of this millennium, because there would be this thing, not only but also, showing up, and of course the three-part list, every time you say something, you say two more things very quickly after it, to kind of sell the point, almost like a salesman, to sell the point. The let's is very bland, but just because it's bland doesn't mean that, you know, I mean, any Labour Party politician would probably say that. Maybe even some Tories would have said the same thing. I think that one thing that is interesting is that he didn't come back on the point, the amazing point that Theresa May made in a recent speech about that, if you're a citizen of the world,
you're a citizen of nowhere,
which is frankly mind-boggling that she would herself have let that get through. Either she's much more stupid than most of us think she is, or she maybe really believes that. But I thought he, and maybe this let's was a way of, but I would have liked to, maybe personal preference, I would have liked him to hit that out of the park, especially in somewhere like Glastonbury. Where else are you going to hit a home run or hit a six, to use a cricketing metaphor, about such an idea?
I understand that cricketing metaphor.
If you were not to say to the Pyramid Stage at Glastonbury, you know, are you citizens of nowhere? You know, because people go there with Wolverhampton Wanderers football flags and East Fife football flags.
Well, there's a strong sense of belonging, isn't there, which is important.
Yeah.
People sort of look out for each other, not entirely, but, you know, that's the part of the mythology of the place. One thing I just wanted to get onto briefly was a word that stuck out for me was something that there was a guy from the University of Sheffield who wrote this blog the other day, which talked in quite critical terms about how a lot of Corbyn supporters, not only Corbyn supporters, but also is present amongst sort of Sanders supporters, so the left globally, let's say, or certainly the statesmen in the UK, where there's a certain amount of conspiratorial thinking. Now, he used the word elites twice, I think, and for me, that when I hear that, I feel a little bit of a shiver, because I think that's a word that is evoking, you know, sometimes a sort of problematic tradition. On the one hand, you know, yes, it's important to talk about, essential to talk about inequality, but on the other hand, you need to talk about capitalism and the way the world works and produces injustice and inequality and so on. You know, if Nigel Farage had been on stage, God forbid, then he probably would have talked about elites. Well, so there's that element of populism. Now, we were talking about populism a little bit last night. I mean, what does that do for you, that word?
Yeah, I think, obviously, when you hear the word elite, and to use an alternative word is problematic. Which word do you want to use? You could say it was a bit lazy, it's a bit problematic, because, of course, that section, which was very near the beginning of the speech, did sound very populist. And it almost sounded like, you could almost pretend that, like, if Donald Trump had been saying that, they said we wouldn't do this, they said you wouldn't do this, they said we didn't matter, and look, we showed them.
Well, it's a bit of a Rorschach thing, isn't it? Because... Yeah. The elites could be the liberal elites.
Yeah. Now, if we take it as his bit of a speech where he's referencing the election results, maybe we can give him some leeway. Maybe we can give him some, give him some space, because without again referencing the election directly, that's kind of what he was doing at that point of the speech, saying, "Didn't we do okay? We didn't win. You didn't have to say that, but we did well." And what he's basically saying is, nobody said we had a chance, and we did well. Now, if I'm
going to have... Well, he used the word commentariat, didn't he, which is an interesting word.
Now, if you say that's it, if you say that when he's talking about the elites, he's not talking about the elites in the general sense, in this conspiratorial sense of lizard-headed figures in the background pulling all the levers, as the right wing might do, but he's talking about the media, for example, the newsprint media and the owners of the print media in the UK, which historically have been against the Labour Party, except, obviously, in 97 when there were four New Labour, if you think he's talking about the media, the proprietors, obviously we believe that Rupert Murdoch left the Tory party very early on the night of the election, when it emerged that it was going to be a hung parliament. And maybe that's
a great moment.
Maybe it's an urban myth. I haven't checked that out myself, whether he actually was there, whether he did leave.
It's nice enough to, I'm happy to believe that.
But if we give Jeremy Corbyn's benefit of the doubt and say when he was using the term elites, he was talking about the media proprietors, then I think we can understand what he's saying. Obviously, you could also look at it from the point of view at the beginning of a speech. It's easy language to use. Again, personally, like you, I don't think it's very helpful to use that overly populist language that you can swap from a right wing podium to a left wing podium. But maybe that's what he was doing with that. And, well, the thing to notice there was too, he didn't keep using the phrase elites during the speech, and he didn't return to it at the end of the speech.
No, he didn't. The only one, it was specifically in the context of the media, as you say. He says the commentariat got it wrong, the elites got it wrong. Now, he could have just not said that. But certainly that was an emotional appeal there. I don't know, I could actually find it. But I've noticed that we've been talking now for 20 minutes, and I think on podcasts generally that's the point at which they have some sort of musical interlude or something like that.
Well, I can go. I'll go away now and I'll print off this speech text and I'll do a more thorough analysis of it.
Oh, you will? Okay, and maybe I can post that.
And if I send it to you, you can see if anything... I think there'll be something else, some other things emerging from that, or we apply some systemic functional linguistic analysis or something to discursive analysis. We'll see things other than buzzwords or phrases coming out, and we might see
buzzwords as in systematic functional linguistics.
Boom.
Okay, thank you very much, Owen.
Okay.